I am Dick Wiegman. The topic for this morning is what is reality, or what is real. I appreciated the fact that Herman Deers this morning at breakfast caught a little bit the pretentiousness of that question. I hope that everybody would. I also enjoyed very much the fact that in Vespers last night, Scott Hazerud emphasized questioning. And certainly when we talk about what is real, that's one of the, I think, the major questions that has to be answered by each one of us. And I'm not going to be so pretentious as to think that I can do it. But I do think that artists can help us and do and have through the ages helped us to define how we understand reality or what we know of it or how we perceive it to be. It's like Pilate asking, what is truth? We ask, what is real? But philosophers and artists have debated this either in words or images for many, many centuries. When we ask questions like this, each one implies something different. It means something different. We can ask, what is a thing called? We can ask first the question, what is it? That's the big question. What is it? We can mean by that, what is it called? We can say, how does it look? We can say, how is it used? What is it like? What does it signify? Or what is it? Artists have different ways of expressing themselves. One of them is through creating likenesses. In other words, the first kind of thing I'm going to talk about is artists who have made an image that looks like a thing looks around us. What is the word that you and I normally use when we talk about that kind of art? When you look at a picture of a sunset over a lake, or it could be buildings, could be a still life, could be a nude, and it looks very faithful to how you see things in your everyday life, what word do we use to describe that?
Realism.
Yeah, we say it's realism, or that's realistic. And we tend to sort of limit the use of the word real or realistic to this one kind of art. And today what I want to do is explore that, plus going on, however, to see how other artists have dealt with these questions. We'll be looking at other parts of ourselves that we have in analyzing or understanding or seeing the things around us. I am ready for the first slide, so we can have the lights out. If we consider to be realistic, don't try too hard. The head of that bird is not on this slide. It's I don't know what kind of whether that's a real bird or not. But very often we define realism in art as being faithfulness to visual fact, how our eyes see things. And I can think of very few instances, though, in the whole history of visual communication and art throughout the millennia, where this has been the goal of the artist. You can come to somebody like John James Audubon, who painted the birds by observation, and we see that he participated as a scientist as well as an artist. And very often we tend, I think in our time, people do, maybe not us, but people in our time define the things around us by observation, and we want to get very factual. But fact is not truth, necessarily. That is something you can talk about or debate sometime. But we tend to look at images like that. Well, we say that's real and it's realistic because it conforms to all the visual facts. Okay, I'm going to show you just a few other instances in the history of art where this has been the goal. And there haven't been very many of them, even though many people would just assume that that has always been the goal of the arts. During the Roman times, Romans looked around them and painted the world the way their eyes saw it. This is a wall painting from Herculaneum or Pompeii, one of those places, where they looked out into the city, and as best they could, and they almost got it right, they painted on their wall what the city looked like to their eyes. Okay. At another point in time, about the 16th, 17th century in Europe, you had this kind of faithful realism also. You had it through the Renaissance, but they really got down to facts and the way their eyes saw the world around them, particularly in Northern Europe at the end of the Renaissance, 16th, 17th century. And then we get to our own time. And a little while ago, 15, 20 years ago, we had people starting a new movement called photorealism, where they would take a photograph, really, and paint what they saw in the photograph, just the way their eye sees it, exactly. Okay. So those three times, we have seen this happen. In Rome, let me just show you another example, a still life, painting simple objects that they saw around them the way their eyes, and then they painted on their wall almost so that you would think that instead of being a painting, that these things were just there on a little shelf. And again, that same time in Northern Europe, 17th century, they became interested in the things around them, simple things like still lives. And then in the 20th century again, the photorealists have gone to things. This is a 20th century still life. Go to a grocery store or a supermarket window and show the things that are there. The main point that I'm making, though, is that in each of these cases, it is what the eye sees that is being reproduced by the artist. Here, again, is a portrait. This is what a Roman matron looked like back in the 1st or 2nd century AD. And we know what she looked like because he painted her that way. Okay. Then you can get to that 17th century in Northern Europe, a man by the name of Vermeer. And he painted a picture of a simple girl, the way she looked, pouring milk out of a pot and so forth. One of the things that I would just call your attention to is the ordinariness, the down-to-earth interest that each of these peoples have shown, the interest in our present world of things and objects and food. This was rather revolutionary, actually, for him to paint this girl a servant. It doesn't seem revolutionary. But it was, because prior to this time, if you painted a young lady, it was very likely to be the Virgin Mary. In other words, she was important. But all of a sudden you have people observing the world around them and willing to paint a servant girl the way they saw her every day. And I can't emphasize enough the word saw, the way they saw her with their eyes. All right, then we get back again to our time. Photorealist, again, he paints in maybe an enormous scale, bigger than the slide that's up there right now. The painting is huge, painted from a photograph in every faithful detail as we see it. Or we get to somebody like Dwayne Hansen. Well, this is a sculpture, okay? You walk into a museum filled with the sculptures of Dwayne Hansen with a bunch of other museum goers, and you have this uncomfortable, uncanny feeling. You don't know who's real and who isn't. You sort of cautiously look around you, and you go up, and you don't want to be staring at somebody, right? But you cautiously go up and test out whether this is a sculpture or not. And you hope for all the world that it is. He actually makes casts of people, and they are plastic resin casts, and then he paints them in meticulous detail, insetting real hairs and everything, dresses them in real clothing and the like. And so this is going about as far as you can go in creating a reproduction of how things look physically around us. It's three-dimensional, it's the same size as we are, it's in our space, and it's just like the people you see at the grocery store or tourists anywhere. Where is this sculpture? I really couldn't tell you. A number of museums have pieces by Dwayne Hansen, so it's a little hard to say. Occasionally they will do one. There's one artist that does nudes this way, and that's really uncomfortable. Yeah. Yeah, you want to participate with them. You know, they share the same flesh and blood reality that we do, except finally you realize that it's all illusion. You know, there is ultimately a difference between them and us, and that is the difference of life and change and movement. You might just keep that in the back of your mind, the difference between things that change and things that don't, because I'll come back to that a little bit later. So if those tourists really create an illusion of reality, the Romans very often were doing that too. They painted this garden inside the wall of their house. Their houses didn't have any windows, and so they painted this to look like when you stepped into the room, oh, there's a garden there, when there really wasn't. Or later on in the 19th century, you had an American artist. This kind of painting is called, in French, the trompe-l'oeil. It means the fool the eye painting, something that is meant to fool the eye. You are meant to not see a painting when you look at the wall, but you are in fact meant to see a rabbit hanging there with a hunting horn and hat and all of these other things. So careful was he to fool you that he never signed the painting in an obvious way, because that would call attention to the fact that it was a painting instead of reality. And so what he would do, he would stick an envelope in the corner of the frame somewhere. Well, he didn't stick an envelope in there, he painted it on. But then he signed his name as if it were addressed to that name, you see. Now he is toying with you, making you believe that there is something here that there is not, you see. And artists like to, I think, fool around with the idea of reality or not. We like illusion. We like our illusions. Now this is not a painting. This is a building that I found in Kansas. And you can see that if you stand in front of the building, you get a totally different impression than if you stand from this angle. You are supposed to see the illusion of this grand, strong bank that you could believe in, one of those things that Elmer was talking about the other night, you know. But when you get around the side, then you see that it is the casual National Bank or something, you know. It isn't what you might expect it to be from another illusion that I just had to bring this one because of the setting where we are. This was, I found this on a grave site in Colorado, a little graveyard in the mountains, surrounded by pine trees, just like you are here at Holden. And I looked on the ground, and somebody had, instead of flowers on the grave, they had put some pine branches, right? Some pine boughs, well, nice thing to do. You use the local materials. Well, these were plastic pine branches. And it just blew me away to think that here you are in this pine forest and somebody brought a bucket of plastic pine boughs, you see. We are willing to accept these substitutes as if they were real quite readily, you know. We have a curious interest, I think, in illusion. But it is illusion, and to create something which seems to be there, which is not, is hardly reality, is it? This is a movie set at the Universal Studios. I had a quotation that I found in one of their advertising brochures. They had quoted various people that were visitors to Universal Studios, and one of the men said, "The Hello Dolly set was the most real thing I've ever seen." what about all the other buildings in the world? You know, it's a strange remark. Our ability to accept illusion as if it were real. So, what does art do? This painting, a kind of surrealist painting by René Magritte. No, wait, we're not getting that focused. Okay, right there. It won't stay in focus. I wish it would, because what is wrong? Well, do you see what's happening here? There is a painting now of a painted canvas sitting in front of an open window. And you question, what is real here? Is it the landscape beyond the window? Is it the painting? They merge exactly. Are they the same? Are they different? You know, what happens here? What happens in art? When an artist creates an image, do we believe in it for that moment? You know, metaphorically, does that become reality for us? I think that's how it works. I think we do, for the moment, have to believe that it is the real thing, and then we can get something from it, probably. Or this other one by Magritte. Now, you'll have to lower this, if you could, because we have to see the top of it. We have to see the top of that. You can say, oh, I'm looking out the window, and there's the ocean out there with some clouds and so forth, right? Well, that's all right if you're looking at the left side, but what about the right side? You say, oh, that thing is painted on those doors, and you've just opened one of them, right? Now, look clear up at the top of that one. No, it's not painted on that door. Somehow I am looking through that now, and there is that seascape behind it. And then you're just comfortable with that, whereas you look in the middle, and you realize, no, it's just darkness out there. The chaos, the void, whatever. Night instead of day. You know, it's a wonderful visual play with us and our quest for what is real. Well, I have to move along, and I shouldn't spend much time. Artists don't just, by the way, paint what their eye sees, even when you think that they do. Here is a photorealist painting of an airstream, you know, and you accept that. That's the way our eye sees things in the world, right? Well, let me just not take a lot of time, but show you. I've got to get this stay in focus. Can you help out there? Why isn't it staying in focus for me? It keeps, that's it. Okay, maybe that'll work now. One of these is a painting and one of them is the photograph from which the artist made the painting. Can you tell which is which? The right is the painting? You all agree with that? You're all, well, those of you who think so were 100% right. And the one on the left is the photograph, okay? So the artist, with his eye, even though he's creating these illusions, he may change things, he may accentuate things. He actually makes them more so than they really are. Over there, he has accentuated the reflections and the colors so that they become more real than they really are. And that's why some people have talked about photorealism. They call it super realism. In other words, it's more real than reality. More real than the way we actually see things. Well, I do want to go on to other kinds of experiences than this visual one, because it's a point that the main point that I want to make here, that there are other ways besides the visual ways for an artist to speak. Here's Mona Lisa. You all recognize her and her almost an infamous smile, her famous smile. And I want you to just look at her eyes, will you please? And you can look at the mouth, because that's the thing that's gotten so much attention over the centuries. Songs have been written about the Mona Lisa smile and all that sort of thing. I want you to look at the shape of a smile. I want you to look at the shape of the nose, and I want you to look at the shape of the eyes. Okay? And this is a portrait of a woman that Leonardo evidently knew. But I'll show you just a couple of details from another one of his paintings. I didn't bring along a lot of slides. I didn't want to weight down the Lady of the Lake too much with too many slides. But I could have brought other examples of his portraits, or angels, or Mary, or the Mother of Mary, This happens to be Mary over on the left and an angel over on the right. And I want you to look at the shape of their eyes, the shape of their nose, and the upturned shape of their mouth. Now I'm going to go back to the Mona Lisa, okay? What? Yeah, did you hear her comment? All the women looked the same back then. Well, not only all the women, I mean, you know that's not true, but not only all the women, but you have to expect that the angels looked like the Mona Lisa, and Mary looked like the mother, her mother looked like the one. He only went, okay, exactly the point. He only had one model. Now, I want you to answer this question. Who or where was the model? In his head. The model was in his head. Now, I think that the lady who posed for the Mona Lisa was a real lady, from we know from history and so forth. But the real model that Da Vinci was interested in was up here, right? Why did he paint them all the same? Right. That was his ideal of the perfect woman. See? The perfect human being, the perfect model. If you're going to paint the Virgin Mary, it ought to be perfect, right? If you're going to make an angel, you ought to make her as perfect as you can. And how do you get that? He got that because of some visual image that he had in his mind. He didn't see that. He certainly didn't see Mary. He didn't see an angel. He did see this woman, but I don't think she looked quite like that either. You know? A little bit, but he... All right, so this is another way of thinking about reality. Let me leave Da Vinci here and go to where this really happened, and that was with the Greeks. Here is a Greek, well, I almost said portrait, but I shouldn't, of a Greek goddess, Athena, the great goddess Athena, goddess of Athens. Now, if you look at any number of sculptures from this particular period about the 5th century B.C., you find that every god and goddess looks about like this. And they all have certain characteristics. They all have very straight noses. They all have very well-shaped mouths, very clean, smooth planes, eyes that are very crisply delineated and so forth. I was in Greece one year for about a month. Northern Greece, Southern Greece, islands, that whole time I spent looking for a person that looked this way. And I came to the conclusion that Greeks don't look that way, see? And probably they never did. Well, it's just like we were saying with Da Vinci, that there was this ideal, this mental ideal that existed in the mind. It's an ideal that has to do with one's idea of perfection, see? Now, Plato believed that, I don't know a lot about Platonic philosophy, but I do know this, that he believed that the flesh and blood of which, what we see around us, he said that was the mere shadow of reality. Now, when we see a shadow, we think, I am real. That shadow is very insubstantial. That's just kind of connected to me, but it's not much, you know. And I'm the real thing. Well, Plato said that real thing exists in the mind. See? Reality is some kind of perfect abstraction existing in the mind, and the flesh and blood is that mere shadow. Okay? Because he was interested in things that don't change, like gods and goddesses and the ideals they represent. He says those things are true, not the people of flesh and blood. Well, let me show you a person of flesh and blood. If you think back to the first part of this presentation, I said that the Romans were interested in this visual, optical fact, right? Now, you can go into a museum of Roman people like this, and you know just what Romans look like, because they carved them. And the interesting thing about it, they didn't flatter themselves. I mean, look at that woman's double chin, her nose. It's about like mine. Her hair, I mean, the funny hairdo, and the lines in her neck and so forth, this is not an ideal image of beauty, right? If we go to a photographer, we want something better than our photograph looks. And we always pick out the one that doesn't look like one, like us. You know, it's the one that looks better, and we think, oh, that looks like us. And all our friends look at all the other pictures, and they say, well, this looks like you. And you say, oh, no, it doesn't. You know, they know what truth is, but we always look for that ideal beauty, and we hope for the best one. See? So that's the difference between the Romans, which were very capable of looking at themselves and accepting just the way the things are in the world, and the Greeks, who wanted something better. They were dealing with abstractions and ideals and concepts of nobility and all kinds of things. We're not talking about a mathematical average here, by the way. This is the average man, the men studying him. This is an image put together by the Air Force. And they had to study many, many human beings in order to design helmets and things like that, and they computerized it and came up with, this is the average man. Now, the Greeks based their ideal image on flesh and blood reality too, looking at many examples, but they didn't arrive at the same conclusions. The Air Force isn't interested in ideals, I don't think. They're just interested in designing helmets that will fit just about everybody okay, you know. So it's when we're talking about ideas, we're not talking about averages. This is, of course, a famous Greek sculpture. You probably recognize, having seen it, of an athlete, of a discus thrower. I'm just going to point out one thing about it. You have to take it on faith that this is true. The moment that they chose to show this discus thrower, and it will say something else about the Greeks and how they thought about what is real and so forth. You know, if we took a movie of a discus thrower nowadays, you would have on that celluloid strip hundreds and hundreds of little images, right? In this continuous movement, everyone different than the others. And if you were taking a photograph for a magazine, you could take any one of those hundreds and put it in the magazine, and we might do exactly that. But the Greeks chose a special moment out of all of those little images on the celluloid that they could have chosen. They chose the one in which the discus thrower has come all the way back. He has ended his preparing, and he isn't quite setting off in the release of that thing either. It's not a continuous action, but it's just in the moment in between preparing and letting go. It's just like when you drive a car, if you think about it, in that moment between driving forward and backing up and driving in reverse, there has to be a moment in which everything stops, right? Just a fraction of a second. Now, one way of thinking about that is that it's kind of an eternal moment where there is no change. Everything is always the same. There isn't any going to happen. There isn't any was. It's just always there. So the Greeks here are defining reality as something that is changeless, finding a moment that is eternal or universal. The Romans later on didn't do this. Their athlete is an old boxer, get that? He's old, he has an age, he's deteriorating, and he's real tired. You look at the face, and he's beat up. I think I have a close-up there. He's beat up, he's got cuts and bruises, he's got cauliflower ears, he's tired, he's been in the ring too many years. This is not an ideal of time. Now, how do you define reality? Do you define it as something that is universal and changeless and timeless? Or do you define reality as something that is in the ongoing process of change and decay that you and I think we experience every day? You know, it's two entirely different things. Here is Dwayne Hansen again. You enjoyed the tourists. Well, here's Dwayne Hansen. The way Ed is sitting over here, he reminds me very much of this. In this, it is a sculpture, I think. The point I want to make is that there is a big difference between looking at somebody just sitting down and, you know, whatever happens, that you know he's going to get up and change. A puff of smoke is going to come up in the next minute. It's got to change because it's got, and it's very casual. It's very undignified and everything else. Now, consider the difference between that conception of what is reality and that of an Egyptian pharaoh who sits very straight. Again, he is of no particular age, very young. He's not growing old yet. He probably died when he was 75. But his body looks very young and youthful. Again, it's like the Greeks. There is this ideal quality that is timeless and ageless. He was a god, after all. When he was buried in that pyramid, those of you who were here yesterday, we talked about that solid shape, remember, that was that would go on forever. Well, his body, in this position, he's not doing anything. It's removed from time. He's not slouching, he's not smoking, he's not doing anything. He just is at this changeless, universal kind of moment, or momentlessness, changelessness, eternity. And so the artist generalizes. He doesn't get specific. Because if he got specific, or if he showed emotion, that would be putting it in terms of time. The Pharaoh, this god, never has any expression on his face. You know, a lot of time when people look at art today, they respond to, oh, look at the expression on his face. I like that pleasant expression, or moody, or whatever. But they deliberately did not have those kinds of expressions, because that would indicate something about time rather than eternity. I'm going to skip that. It's the same kind of idealized thing, although it's more modern. But here is a sculpture by Brancusi, and you wonder maybe how this fits in here. Let me read you a quotation by Brancusi, and it will sum up again very much kind of the kind of thing that Plato was saying. He said, "Only the essence of things is real, not the outward form. Whoever accepts this truth will not expect to express anything essential by imitating outward appearances." So for an artist like this, it is really kind of silly or frivolous or whatever to be trying to imitate outward appearances. He says, that's not what's important. He says, the essence of the thing is what's real, not the outward appearances. So, you know, what I'm suggesting is when we use the word realistic about the things which conform to our eye, which may fool us, as you saw with illusion, you know, maybe that's not what reality is. Do you have any, do you want to ask anything or discuss anything at this point about what I've said or shown you so far?
Does it have to be either or? In other words, could it be that both are real?
Does anybody else want to respond to that? Yes. Okay. At least you hope not. Well, that's an interesting parallel, because we do talk about creating an image, don't we, for ourselves. We know that some politicians would never make it if they didn't have a whole bunch of people behind them changing their image, making us believe these people are what they are not. You know, they worked on Mondale, it seems to me, and so forth, to make him more attractive and more personable than some of these other politicians, and make them more to come across on television, to have them. Yeah, I think that's true, that we can have an image or create an image that isn't essentially there. That's exactly it, yeah. Yeah.
Over and it's entirely different to what you perceive and when you're there, or you wait a second and it's entirely different. I mean, you could be in that have that sense that reality, there isn't such a thing as reality. It's all a kind of a past phenomenon. Or you could say reality is whatever you make it at that moment. That sort of thing. But it really destroys that notion. That, I mean, what is the essence? Pretty simple. It'll be different for every person and at every moment. It's kind of unsettling, isn't it?
We're to raise questions, right?
Just by asking, what is the essence? Plato would say, now that's my boy. But these Romans you were talking about probably didn't even ask that question. They just says, "What? Let's make a picture of Joe the way we saw him this morning. And whatever that is that comes off, that is Joe. They would even talk about, is there a deeper Joe behind that? Mm-hmm. I think because the Greeks, you know, this is a little not philosophical, it's Christian theological. I think the Greeks were scared by change because that's mortality and that's passing away and perishing and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't find anything that didn't perish, and so they just just said, we're going to say there are these things that don't change. Mm-hmm. And what we do see is just the shadows, and the realities are something else that you never see.
Yeah. And I think perhaps as Christians we live in the tension between the two. You know, we know that we are living in this world and we act out our lives and so forth with an eternal hope, but there is there is that tension. I'm not done yet presenting other ways of perceiving reality or defining it. There are some other ways I think that artists have done it, and those are the good questions, and I don't think we're going to answer them today.
I don't know whether I should. I'll try to just briefly here say what I had in mind. The Egyptians did not show things the way their eyes saw them. Just one example. You know, if you ever looked at an Egyptian figure drawing, okay? I'll try to stand like an Egyptian figure drawing, okay? I've got my legs this way. You can look up there. You don't have to watch me fall over. I will try to have my legs parallel on a straight line, have my body turned this way, and my head turned that way, and I can just almost do it. But there's something that I can't do. I can't turn my eye around to the front, okay? So I won't even try that. I've tried it before, and it's never worked. But then you think, oh, well, they're just incompetent artists because they couldn't show things the way their eyes saw them. They hadn't developed yet. You know, there must be something wrong. And when we want to look at art and say the best kind is the thing that most directly imitates the thing that we see, which, by the way, is how Leonardo once defined art, then we think this comes up short, you know? But let me just point out to you briefly what they were doing. They were making it clear, not how our eye sees things, but they were making a very clear statement. I'm not prepared to draw today, I guess, but I could show you that the side view of an eye is not nearly as clear an idea about an eye as the front view. Or have you ever tried sometime to draw a human face front on? You know, what do you do about the nose? You ever tried to draw the nose? Is it two holes? Or how do you make this thing stick out, see? But if you draw the profile, then you can much more easily draw the nose and what the face is like. So they combine whatever view will make their idea most clear. And we sometimes talk about it as being conceptual rather than visual. They want to get the idea across. And even look at the fact here how the bodies go yellow, red, yellow, red, yellow, red, yellow. Notice that? It doesn't mean that every other Egyptian was a different color and neatly stood in rows like this. What does that mean? It helps us to separate them. Look at their legs. If they were all the same color, how would you know whose legs they were? See? So it helps us to get the concept. Children will do many of the same things as the Egyptians. I'm going to skip that. I think I want to get to other things. But children and Egyptians, by the way, are very much alike in some of the things that they do. Here you have a picture of a pharaoh, his face is damaged, and his wife, and some servants, or a son probably in the front there. And notice how big the Pharaoh is. I mean, he's huge. He's bigger than his wife. He's a lot bigger than the servant. You can see Egyptian works where you have the Pharaoh is real big and the enemies are real little. Now, it isn't because they were physically that way. What were they saying? What was the idea they were getting across? All right, the Pharaoh is a person in power. Right, what? Dominion over the others? Any other ideas? It shows social status, his standing, his importance, not in how the eye sees him, but how we know him to be. Again, it's a concept, see? So they were actually able to visualize the concept, and they didn't care whether it looked like the guy looked relative to others in the real world. Or children, and Egyptians would do the same thing, they would show two views of something at the same time. This painting by the child is called Parachute Play. They had a parachute and they were playing with it, as kids often do in preschool and so forth. But you're looking down at the parachute, but you look at all these little side views of the children. You ought to be looking at the top of their heads, but have you ever tried to draw the top of a person? What does it look like? It doesn't look like a person at all. See, it doesn't get the idea across very clearly. And so it's much better to take the characteristic side view and put these guys, little guys, all flat around the parachute. But have you ever tried to draw the side view of a parachute? You know, what's the side view of a parachute? So you get the top view of that. The Egyptians did exactly the same thing. Yeah. Okay, that's right. The side. Have you ever? Yeah. Think about the top view of a slide. If you saw that, you wouldn't know what it was. See. And the other thing is, has a child ever seen the top view of a slide? Well, maybe, maybe not. But you see, you recognize the slide because the child enabled. He gave you the characteristic view so that you could do that. See. So what is more clear and more real? To have everything very consistent. Even though to our eye, when we look at it, we can't recognize it, 50% of the things that we would see, we would know what they are. Or is it more clear and a better definition of reality to show us everything so that we can understand it? Well, I want to go on, because there's another important way of seeing reality, and that is through our emotions. And this kind of art that was pretty much started by Van Gogh, self-portrait here, doesn't show this. If you think back to those original images, that photorealist image of the huge face looking just like a face looks, Van Gogh didn't look just like this. He didn't have brush strokes all over his face, see? And his face wasn't quite as angular as this. He manipulates, he changes things a little bit from the way our eye sees them. And in so doing, oh gosh, look at the relationship between the ceiling and this thing here. But in so doing, he was able to reveal forces of nature. He didn't care that stars were little specks up there. He says these were great hurtling bodies of energy going around in great orbits and so forth, far beyond what they appear to our eye as little dots, see? He was listening to the great rushing hymns of all of these planets and things, and he was distorting what his eye saw to celebrate what he says it really is, or what he felt it was. And so we get expressionists who distort shape and color in order to create an emotional impact. And I would just put this question to you then. Oh, by the way, in this setting, I had to bring this. This is called The Devil and the Scholar. There's a scholar with his book ready to stumble off the edge, I suppose, and a big Satan in front here, big devil. But how do you create an image of something like a devil? How do you image these great internal devils that we have? How do you visualize things? We all have stormy emotional times in our lives when we shout with joy or cry with anguish or sadness or bitterness. And the question becomes, is that emotional reaction not real? is how you see a situation through your emotional vision, not a real one. And so we have these emotional, these expressionists that show us ecstasy or dancing or music or joy or intense anguish. This is called a dead mother. It looks like a dead child here, but it's called the dead mother. And it's all distorted, but you say, yes, but isn't our intense emotional experience real? You know, doesn't that help us grapple somehow? I don't know if it helps us, but we do grapple with reality through that way. We're about running out of time, but I should just at least mention this other area. We ought to get Scott Hauserud to come in and talk about this, I suppose, because you have the whole area of fantasy, and if that sounds a little unreal to you, let's use the word subconscious, where you have somebody like Salvador Dali creating things which can only be compared to what? Dreams or nightmares, one or the other. And what the Surrealists were saying was that there is a certain reality in our subconscious thought, just as there is in our conscious thought. And they were trying to create a shock by bringing the two together, the unconscious and the conscious. What is real? Can one thing be two things at once? What do you see when you look at this? What do you see here? Okay, you see the dog? Everybody see the dog? You convinced that it's an image of a dog up there? The dog's head in the upper right? And the collar of the dog, see the kind of flea collar or something that the dog has on? All right? It's over there on the left, yeah, and you see but let's look at that upper right again. It's a mountain scene. Instead of a dog's head, all of a sudden that becomes a mountain, doesn't it? And the eye, can't see this too clearly here perhaps, but the eye is really kind of a hole through the mountain. You know, it's kind of a natural arch there. And then the dog collar is now a bridge. Yeah. So he is really playing with us and asking, can one form be two things at once? Oh, in ordinary experience, probably not. But in art, it can. That's one of the interesting things. In science, that could never happen, that one form could be two things. But in art, it can. Perhaps our religious life, our life of faith, one thing can be two things at once. I'm always intrigued. I think I mentioned yesterday in some connection with the Lord's Supper that we can have both body and bread and wine and blood simultaneously. Perhaps something like this helps us to say, oh yeah, you know, it gives us a glimpse of how one thing can be two levels at one time. And so that brings up questions of spiritual reality and so forth. What I've tried to do today is suggest or show you ways that artists have approached the things in the world around us and shown us reality. There's some things that we did not get to quite at all. But if we look at the visual approach to reality, that's different from the approach of the mind. It's different than the approach of belief in something greater than what is here and now. It's different than maybe our emotional perceptions, which color the things that we know and see. Or maybe the subconscious has another kind of reality in helping us to sort out things, or maybe confusing us, I'm not sure. We haven't talked too much about spiritual reality, and tomorrow what I hope to do is I've t- title the talk, Entering a Different World. And we'll talk about specifically and mostly the art of the Byzantine, the Orthodox world. And we'll see how just by deliberately going against how we ordinarily see things, they enable us to enter a kind of a spiritual level. And it's a real, you know, traditional Christian art of the Byzantine world and the Orthodox world. Do you have anything else that you would like to just say, though, here, or ask before we quit? Ed?
A minute ago, as you were winding up, you said something about one form can be two things. That's different from science, where one form cannot be two things. Did you say something like that?
Yeah, am I wrong? I haven't heard his presentation.
I think that's going to be some circles again tonight when he's doing things on the new physics, where, I don't know if he'll use the word form and thing, but he'll talk about at least one thing can be two forms. Light is both, or can be viewed, you know, as quanta, little particles, and as waves. And in the equation, you can't have both, but each equation by itself works. And so here's one. Either one form that is two things, or one thing that's two forms simultaneously. I don't know how close that is to this Dali-esque thing, but it might be an interesting kind of correlation.
But what I'm hearing you say is that it can be approached from two ways.
Yeah. But the question is, well, is it little particles, or is it waves?
Mm-hmm. And
well, it all depends.
Yeah, it's
just like you said, you know, is that a face, or is that a face with powder or with hair in it?
You know, what Herman asked before, you know, are they mutually exclusive? Is it just, does it have to be one way or another? Or is it the sum total of all of these things? You know, it's just like saying, you know, we know that's hard. It just really worries me sometimes to think that that's nothing but little electronic pluses and minuses. You know, and now they're getting to the point where they think that there are some particles that are not even that. You know, and finally you're left with, this isn't anything at all, and yet I know it is. Herman?
Yeah, I think there's a wonderful connection between the architect that Van Gogh's Starry Night portrayed it a little bit. Just think, he had those swirling things up there in the sky before we even knew about galaxies. Galaxies were discovered or whatever in this century. Van Gogh did that in the 19th century.
Yeah, it might have been known, but the point is, I think what you're saying, he discovered it intuitively.
Right.
Yeah.
And the connection there is that often you need the enlarged imagination of the artist to assist the scientist to imagine how some kind of configuration that can hold all this data together. You said that facts aren't truth. You know? Vernosky has a great thing about how facts are of no use at all unless you give them some coherence, some imaginative conceptualization that holds them all together. And so the Dali, the conceptualization that's able to hold together a whole variety of data. That's really what the scientist is about. Same thing.
Buck Rogers? Yeah.
Thomas Kuhn, with his book that's now, 20 years old, in effect was making that point, the structure of scientific revolution. At least, as I understand it, and I'm not technically a scientist, he said, you know, the old Ptolemaic worldview and the Copernican one were not really based on the fact that folks got a lot more facts. It's just that the pictures that Ptolemy drew, which made sense out of almost all of what they had, and Ptolemy never saw the whole thing, you know, with his eyes, he saw the whole picture by looking out one night, and neither did Copernicus. But Copernicus said, wait a minute, there's a couple of things that don't fit well in Ptolemy's picture, so I'll try to draw a different kind of picture and see if we can get all that stuff in there. But in both cases, there was a picture. Mm-hmm. And a picture is what, you know, you make your living off of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm fascinated by the thing inscribed on the lectern over there. Elmer should have mentioned it last night, or Sunday, because that's this Sunday's epistle lesson, this past Sunday.
we have this treasure in our frozen vessel. And I think I'm fascinated by that and by the connection with Plato. Plato would say, the treasure is what counts. Your earthen vessel is irrelevant, or at least it passes away. And I think Paul says, no, both count. I'm an earthen vessel, mortal, ephemeral, passing. But in Christian theology, both the Creator and the Redeemer said, you know, earthen pot, sometimes cracked pot, Edward, you count. And the treasure that I've entrusted you, that counts too. So is it treasure or is it earthen vessel? And the answer is yes.
Yeah, it's that tension, I think, that I was mentioning before, that we live under both.
We buy in so much to the conventional wisdom of seeing is believing. When somebody has said, for the Christian and for the artist, believing is a way of seeing.
That's also in this week's epistle lesson. Oh. So we look for the things, not the things that are seen, but the things that are unseen. Now that's a pun or a play on words, but that's got something to say with what Bill says. I'm not sure what it's.
I was going to bring that up tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know whether I mentioned this yesterday or not, but if Herman asked me for a title for the series, and I didn't think of the complete one that I should have, because really, I think that seeing plus faith equals vision. That's how I would like to think of this or title that. But it's both. You know, we have our human, again, it's that same thing. We have our human vision with our eyes of physical things, but we have faith, which is also an insight, you know, helping us see. And this is finally vision of our role in our present life in the world, but it's also the vision of, you know, glory or treasure.
Visions aren't dreams, they are like faith, it's a particular angle of vision, an informed vision, that sort of thing, and not just a phantasmagoria of images.
I've forgotten who's supposed to have said it. It must be someone from your tradition, your artist. That style is a way of seeing. It might even have been a literary guy, Baudelaire or somebody, although I think it was a graphic, yeah. You know, visual artists. But what you've in effect given us is some of the classical styles, mm-hmm. Greek, Roman, mm-hmm. and others, and they are different ways of seeing.
Yeah, or in art we might talk about the romantic being emotional, or classical being the Greek, and so forth.
Emotions consciously in focus when I do my seeing, or keeping them out when I do my seeing,
mm-hmm.
or et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I like to play around with that little phrase. I ought to find out sometimes who said it and say, in that sense, the Christian faith is a kind of style. It proposes a particular way of seeing reality,
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Well, maybe not so well, but...
The fellow that did the ceiling, Rich Kemmerer, I believe, said that art... Well, I guess we would call those slides... Generally, you say that's art, but he said art is really the process, and those are artworks.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives a dynamic to art that, you know, normally we don't even think that way.
Yeah, I heard him say that this spring, too, and I agree with that, you know, that it's just a kind of a dead thing. An image is just nothing at all until somebody interacts with it. And so you might ask, well, I guess that's the most philosophical question. Does something exist in the dark, you know? But does a work of art, does an image have any existence without our thought process or interaction? I guess that's another question one could think about, yeah.
My first look at the ceiling last year, and my comment was, he's really got something here. Mm-hmm. I couldn't see a thing. Tell somebody to explain it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not altogether bad. I think that sometimes, you know, the specifics of a thing, specific symbolism has to sometimes be explained. That's sometimes the nature of symbolism.
the function of raising the question.
Mm-hmm.
You see a work of art, if you don't understand it, it may still raise a question, which then allows an opening for explanation, perhaps.
And the purpose of art isn't necessarily to find out what the artist had in his mind. The purpose of art, I think, is to open you up to know what you have in your mind. You know, there's this dialogue between the work of art and you. So you really discover what you think and believe, more so than having to think you should discover what the artist was thinking and believing. Yeah. Let me, as long as you're still here and there's still a few interesting, I'm not going to show the slides that I had for this, but let me just this is how I was going to close. We started off by saying that a lot of people look at art that imitates how some other things look, and they call that real, we call that, you know, visual. And then we have artists in the 20th century who are creating works of art that don't look like anything at all, right? It may just be a shape or a chunk of stone, just color on a canvas. And a lot of people think there is nothing there. See? I don't see anything. They say, what is it? It isn't much of anything. I don't see anything. Well, it is something. If we're talking about reality, the artist has created now something in itself. It doesn't refer to anything outside of itself. It doesn't refer to a tree or a building or an apple. But he is creating something that exists in the same way that a tree or a building or an apple exists. In other words, it has its own reality now. He is creating something that isn't an illusion of something that isn't there, but he is making an object that has its own real existence to be contemplated as an object in the same way that you would contemplate a tree or an apple or something. You understand what I'm trying to say? Yeah. And so you kind of come full circle. And so all these people that want to deny any sense of reality to contemporary non-objective abstract art, maybe they're wrong. See, maybe that is more real than the illusion.
The illusion is itself real. Then it's not. It's an illusion of something else, but it's what it is itself, then, just as much as the abstract.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're saying it's not real, it's only an illusion about that other thing which is real.
That kind of art creates the reality of an illusion.
Yeah.
And that's at least the thing that's real in your head. You know, you look at the Da Vinci Last Supper, and you know, you don't think about that picture, but you think about Jesus and Matthew, Mark, Luke, or no, that's what the disciples, Peter, James, and John,
yeah,
and all of those. And you're shifting from the canvas that you're looking at to your biblical imagery.
Yeah.
That's what gets created by this crazy thing.
Mm-hmm. And the real value of the illusionistic work, the realistic work, lies, I think I mentioned in the beginning, in our ability who was the poet, Keats or Shelley or something, talked about suspending our disbelief. You know, we go to the theater, read a poem, we have to suspend our disbelief and believe this illusion for a moment. Then we can get something out of it. You know, if we forget the fact, we have to forget the fact that it's a picture. We have to believe that it's apples. We have to, that's the nature of a metaphor. And then we can get something out of it. But if, as long as we go on saying, oh no, that's just a picture of an apple, so we probably won't get that one either, see?
You think an artist, you know, like, is it Juan Perro? Juan, he was a Spanish artist.
Miro?
Perro.
Miro.
Oh, yeah.
And Miro.
Yeah. He had a showing when we were there in Munich, and in the big art museum there, and boy, when he walked down the place, he was just quiet. But, you know, some of the things that he had, you know, like that big thing there, maybe not that big, but just in the center, a red
mm-hmm.
piece of stroke or something like that. Whew. That's hard to imagine something out of that, but, you know, he was great. And everybody apparently thought he was great, but at that time I didn't think he was so great. Mm-hmm. I was looking at something that, you know, I wanted to see something there. I didn't want to.
But you did. You did.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I did.
Yeah, you saw a red stroke. You know, some black marks and a big red circle, and that is something. See? That really is something.
But everybody doesn't have to like what somebody else likes. I mean, everybody has their own eye, their own vision. It's like a three blind men explaining what an elephant looks like. You know, it depends on where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to like it. Mm.
Dick, is that a modern phenomenon about whether you like or don't like art, a particular object of art? You know, do you know whether in the Renaissance or back in the Roman days, people would even have understood this little discussion, that someone would ever have said, I like it or I don't like it? It'd be like saying, I like or I don't like the sky. People say, well, you know, that's irrelevant. What difference does that make? But nowadays, we think, at least whether I like it or I don't like something, is pretty important.
Yeah, that's interesting. Of course, they didn't have as many choices in those days either. They had only maybe one style that was very universal. And today, and they were only aware of probably the things that were painted in a very contemporary way. They didn't have museums.
You know. I just wondered, do you know whether...
No, I don't.
The Romans and Greeks, as they walked around the countryside or through the marketplace, whether anybody ever said, I like that or I don't like that, you know, whether that was ever even a kind of response. Whether that's a modern phenomenon for us Westerners to say it's important whether I like it or don't like it, I'm going to tell you whether I do or don't.
I don't know. They might have said, I like not the work of art so much as that figure or that cow. And again, it'd be preferences, but you wouldn't have the styles to debate.
Oh, people you don't like, but I wonder if were just, they're givens.
Don't you think there must have been likes and dislikes, or there wouldn't have been change? If there hadn't been dislikes, then change wouldn't have occurred.
Well, I don't know about that. Might have been some, you know, somebody else just got a new idea. Not that he said, you know, I don't like this. He said, hey, last night I was dreaming and ha, I saw this in my head. I never saw that before. So it's not that I disliked this other one. Here's something I never saw before and I'm going to do that.
Well, I don't think it worked that quite as quickly as it did, as it does in our own time. Or as personally, I think it was more of a cohesive cultural force. And art tended, like everything else, to be much more traditional. If you look at a culture like the Egyptians, that culture went on for nearly 3,000 years without a great deal of change. And so we see change so much faster. You know, and today we also have the possibility of artists proclaiming something on a personal basis. I make it art because this is me, and I think that has been very rare. You look at tribal societies; they wouldn't understand that an individual would have something to say about art. In small ways, sure, they make small changes, but it's all part of a bigger culture. And how can a person in that culture say they don't like art? It would be like saying they don't like reality. You know, in that case, like the Egyptians, if they said, I don't like the way you depicted that thing, it'd be like saying, I don't believe in the gods or the afterlife or anything. It had to be done just that way because that's the way it had always been done. So there really wasn't the chance to say they didn't like it or not. You would be throwing out not art, but you would be throwing out what?
Communication.
Of the whole society's standards, their values, their beliefs, the things that they teach their children. You know, you use the arts to talk about what you believe in your tribe or your society. And today it's very different than that.
But don't you think part of that has to do, too, with our communication ability today? I mean, we have television in all these homes. People are exposed to many, many different things. We're exposed to a lot of history. But we're exposed to current happenings within minutes after they happen, so that you have such a broad range of exposure that gives you more ability for these new ideas and new creations, thoughts or mm-hmm. ability to put things into creation of paintings or sculpture or batik or whatever.
Sometimes I think with a lot of discomfort that art along these traditional lines is really very irrelevant anymore because of what you're saying. You know, we have imagery coming at us electronically, and we can get so many things that the traditional painting seems a little archaic, you know, as an image that maybe a few people will see somewhere.